Hello, and welcome to The Alt Left.
Welcome back, everybody, to The Alt Left. It is January 12th, episode 8. The country's on fire. Everyone's at each other's throats. And today, we're going to talk about something even more divisive: money. Who's got it? Who needs it? Where did it all go? So please sit back and enjoy, or at least try to enjoy, a long talk about economics. And put on a pot of coffee. This one gets real boring. But joining me today, as usual, is the good Reverend Dr. K.
Good evening, everyone.
And my good friend Matthew McConaughey.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for coming back.
So, let's before we get into the just riveting world of supply-side economics, I think we have a little bit of housekeeping to do, don't we, Matt?
We do indeed. So, a bit of correction. One thing that we absolutely are committed to here on the alt-left is we want to make sure we always have our facts straight. It's one of the reasons we encourage our listeners to reach back out to us with any corrections they might have. And one of the things we want to correct is on our previous episode when we were discussing the riots at the Capitol building, we mentioned a story about a protester, rioter, Trumper, who tased himself in the balls and had a heart attack and died. Slight correction to that story. The tasing part is actually a complete fabrication, which we were shocked to find out. A lot of major news stories ran with it. The truth of the story is actually less noteworthy. Turns out, like, he didn't even get inside. As soon as people started rushing the building, the excitement, he just had a heart attack and died. Period. No tasing, no testicles, no nothing. I know it's one of those stories that sounds exactly like it's something that could have happened, so I think that's why it gained so much steam. But turns out it absolutely did not. Guy's wife came out on it. Snopes did an article on it. I've seen a couple places actually retract it. So we're doing the same just to keep ourselves honest here.
Yeah, I'm not going to lie. Finding out Santa Claus wasn't real was a less painful lie to learn about than this one.
Right? It's one of those things you just, you expected it. It's something that sounds so much like a Trumper would do to themselves too, right?
And you just want it to be true. Like, I would just love it if everyone who stormed the Capitol died from tasing themselves in the balls. That would just be amazing. But alas, it's not true. And we got to have a commitment to the truth.
Happy endings only happen in Disney movies.
And at massage parlors.
For the right price.
But human trafficking aside. But yeah, thank you for bearing with us on that. Housekeeping is important. We got to keep ourselves in the truth and keep honest at all times. Because those who can make you believe absurdities can make you commit atrocities. And speaking of absurd lies, let's talk about American economics.
Oh boy, this is going to be fun.
Not even a little, but it's important. It's like getting a vaccine. It's not a great time, but it's important. And it's good to know what's true and not. And instead of being a hippie mom on a toilet doing our own research, let's look at some actual facts. What do you guys think of when we think of the term wealth inequality?
For us, it means the growing divide between the wealthiest Americans in the U.S. and the poorest.
What it means to me is that we have, that we no longer have a middle class. We have the upper class and we have the lower class. And that disappearing of the middle class that we used to have before like 1950-ish, moving into where you have poor people and rich people and no one in between, means that the American dream is dead.
Yep. And I couldn't agree more. That was actually probably the best point to make on this one, because we have this idea in the United States, most of the Western world now, but that's almost because we've spread that the middle class is a natural part of capitalism, that capitalism will breed innovation. It will make some people wealthy. Some will be poor, and there will be a big giant chunk in the middle where everyone's happy and living in a house with two cars and, you know, 3.5 golden retrievers or whatever the American dream is supposed to be.
Picket fence. Don't forget the picket fence.
Picket fences. It's one car, 2.5 children. There's that half child that everybody's looking for.
Maybe they should look at the golden retrievers, find out where they're putting them. This dream of the middle class is a fluke, and I wanted to, if we could, take us down a, a good boring history lecture, really, because if we're going to have a nice boring talk about economics, let's put them to sleep first with history.
I think you mispronounced farce.
I spelled it with America. So, yeah, it is a farce, because that's the thing, is the middle class shouldn't exist. When we think of human evolution in society, if we're going to talk about cultural anthropology kind of thing, most societies, yes, of course, obviously, hunter-gatherer states, we all band together to screw over Cave 73. But when we start actually planting root-having society, you have a few people running everything, and then everyone else is, you know, farming beetles in the mud, right? And so the first time we really see an emergence of the middle class is in the medieval era and shortly after. In fact, the term bourgeois and bourgeoisie are French, because that's where this was really first notated. And the middle class were not what we consider middle class. I guess the first thing we need to take care of is the classical definition for that is not a nuclear family making their way, doing good. It was the idle rich. It was incredibly wealthy people.
Dukes, barons, big landowners, no, things like that?
Quite the opposite. Landowners, yes, and a very wealthy merchant class. And that thing is they were the middle between the nobility and the peasantry.
Gotcha.
So you had your kings, queens, dukes, baronesses, viceroys, blah, blah, blah. You had your noble titles, right? And they were wealthy by simple inheritance. They were wealthy by winning the genetic lottery. And then you had the next class, which became almost as wealthy. You know, these guys worked their way in. This merchant class became incredibly wealthy, started owning large tracts of land, which they could collect their own taxes and money on and rents on. And owning land throughout classical Europe became a great way to make a crap ton of money, much like today, but even better. That was the game. That was the game in town. Right now, owning Amazon, you know, that's the good game. Owning a major provider of consumer goods or an industry is where you make money now. But back then it was owning land, because if you owned land, people could farm, people could live on it, whatever. Everyone had to pay you simply for existing on it. It required no work. So that's who the middle class was. That was the dreaded bourgeoisie, was they were the idle rich who did no work, contributed not to society, and they weren't even the people in charge of running the society. They were just a bunch of leeches, right? But then eventually that disappears. We as West in the Western society, we get rid of these monarchs, right? Whether through revolution or through gradual change, we end up getting rid of monarchy, and we start seeing republics and democracies in their crude form start to emerge, right? And by the dawn of the 20th century, it's toast. It's gone. There is no royalty anymore. So that idle rich class becomes that head ruling class. They become the ones at the top with all the goods. And everyone else works for them. We don't have a middle class. We have two classes. So you've got the people who own mines, the people who own farmlands, the people, and not, I'm talking about like homesteaders. I'm talking about major and, you know, captains of industry, your Rockefellers, your Morgans, you know, the people who are masters of finance and are running, you know, stock exchanges and running their own banking institutions, you know, Carnegie Steel, you have the Rockefellers, you have the Chase Morgan bankers, you know, these people running, you know, captains of industry or robber barons, depending on what your viewpoint of them was, they were the modern nobility. They owned everything, including senators. And everyone who worked for them, again, we're talking about child labor in coal mines. We're talking about people were doing agricultural work, people breaking their backs in steel mills, 80-hour work weeks, no OSHA, cops were murdering people for joining unions and going on strikes. This tenement housing where people, you know, you'd have 50 people shoved onto the floor of an apartment that was built for eight. You know, this was what the city offered. This was what American society offered. Those were the two economic classes. And then all of a sudden, World War II happens. You know, World War I didn't change much economically. It industrialized the United States, but it didn't really change the economic landscape. If you look at 1930s America, economically, it wasn't much different than 1900 America. Whereas if you look at 1935 America and look at 1945 America, huge difference. Fast forward to 1955 America, and it's a whole different planet. And that's because something really happened during World War II. The middle class exploded after that because, you know, soldiers came home and we had built this huge industrial giant basically, right? We funded everything. By the time we actually even started getting semi-involved, I'm talking about boots on the ground, but when we started really getting involved with assisting the Allies in World War II, they were already toast. We were doing the Lend-Lease programs with Great Britain and Russia, and we were building half the gear. You know, Russia was building the other half, and we were building our automotive industries got brought into it. Franklin Roosevelt had this entire economic plan built to turn the entire private sector into the public sector to crank out tanks. That was the goal. Airplanes, tanks, guns, boots, fuck everything else. Anyone tells you that they've got a 1942 Ford to sell you, he's lying, because there were no cars being built. Nothing was being built. Women were literally drawing lines on their legs to make it look like they were wearing nylons because it was all rationed. Every single resource was going to this war, and we were cranking out stuff not just that beat all American records, beat human records. At no point in human history up until that point had that much shit ever been produced at that rate, period, no matter how you want to measure it.
Well, and there was more innovation that happened during those times as well.
Yeah.
Because of the amount of actual production growth. People were redesigning everything and everything all the time.
Yeah.
So not only did we get more made, but we made it better and produced it faster than any other point in history.
Yeah.
And back then, they used to build shit to last forever. Now we have a thing called planned obsolescence.
Which is?
Planned obsolescence is, you know, your cell phone is only going to work for 2 years. And they know that. And so by putting components that will last just long enough to get them past the warranty part, and then you buy a new one. It's meant to keep you consuming new ones. But yeah, you're completely right, Kay. We radicalized industrial building. And then, of course, right after this, the soldiers come home and we have this huge explosion of a middle class all of a sudden, out of nowhere. These soldiers who were brought up in homes where they canned food to survive the winter. They were doing laundry services for other people on the side. All, you know, they were newsies growing up just to help feed the babies. And all of a sudden, we've got a single income family living in a suburban home, owning a car, going on vacations, having retirement benefits. This didn't exist in America until then. But we tend to, as Americans, we tend to look at that with this view of American exceptionalism. That, well, yeah, because we're America and Uncle Sam shits bald eagles that are made of gold and everything's great because we're America. And that's not true. It's that we survived World War II without taking a scratch. The war never got fought on our shores. When the war ended, our banking industry was functioning. Our raw materials were being farmed at the greatest rate in human history. Our manufacturing was pumping and cranking. And on top of that, these other nations, whether they, no matter what side they were on, if they were the Allies, they owed us a crap ton of money because we didn't give the Allies tanks and planes to save us from Germany. We loaned them and leased them. And that when under the understanding that when the war was over, they were going to pay us a lot of money. As Western Europe is rebuilding, they're literally paying us back their loans and they're rebuilding with the industry that we create. You know, things like Bessemer converters, they didn't have any left over. We were cranking those out to make steel out here. We sold them. All the industrial equipment in the UK and France in the 1950s was all made in the United States, all of it. So we had this insane influx of wealth just from what we charged them and what we sold to them. And on top of that, we had no competition. You know, Europe has been firebombed to hell. It's done. It's literally a pile of rubble. China has been raped and pillaged and burned by the Japanese. We nuked and firebombed the Japanese, and Germany was literally seven guys standing around wondering what to do next. Southeast Asia hadn't even been developed yet. It was Russia and China and Japan were going to fight over that soon. Everyone needed us. We were the only game in town. If you wanted industrial-made goods, you had to buy American, not because it was the best or the brightest or that's what you liked. No, it's because you couldn't. You couldn't go to France and pick up fresh new steel. It didn't work that way. You picked that up from here. And so with this, we had this influx of money and influx of high sales because we were the only ones who had consumer goods and industrialized goods. And so this massive rise of America as the world's economic power was not because we're so special. It's because we were vultures. We were opportunists. There was a golden opportunity to make an ass ton more money, and we took it. And unlike today, back then we spent a little bit of it on the inside, because what helped us build, you know, kind of like what you were saying, Kay, is that it, earlier, that if people understood, you know, if industries understood that if they paid people more, there would be more money to go around. That idea was around back then. And so we had the GI Bill, right?
Yeah.
June of 1944, the GI Bill comes out, and it's huge. You know, this revolutionized the country. It gave us funding for education. People got crazy good deals on home loans. Meanwhile, we're laying down massive, huge tracts of suburban homes that are priced to own. Now you can get a cheap home loan with no credit. You're getting a college education and a great job. You're getting health care for you and your family, all because you were a veteran. Your whole family was taken care of.
Hold on. So you're telling me when you invest in the working class, everyone gets richer?
It's amazing, right?
I am shocked.
Rising tide raises all boats.
I am shocked, I tell you.
So yeah, we had a housing boom. We had an industry boom. We had a baby boom. Because obviously everyone's got money and food and a house. They're, you know, marriages didn't happen during World War II. Most of the men were gone. And even the ones who were staying behind, no one was really planning for that. People were rationing butter. There was very few babies born, very few weddings. And then all of a sudden, all the soldiers come back home. Everyone's getting hitched. Everyone's making babies. Everyone's going to college. That's what happened. And with the rise of the Cold War, this idea of American consumerism that we were already being sold, you know, to make sure these factories who are cranking out tanks and airplanes so hard, well, we can't slow that down. That's good for business. So now we're cranking out cars and washing machines and dryers and, you know, and other kitchen appliances and just everything you could need, you know, an automatic cigarette lighter that looks like a monkey waving a Charleston flag. Like that's what was made. And we had to have this consumer culture. It was literally sold to us as the DC sold this to us as quote unquote the good life that you couldn't get over in Russia. We then take over the empire from the British and the French. So now we've got dibs on the ocean and all the shipping lanes. And America is now out of nowhere. This backwards farming country is running the world's economy. And everyone's got to buy from us. The thing is, that doesn't last. So it creates this amazing middle class, creates this robust working class of people who are living great lives, participating in the economy. Everything's wonderful until the 70s and 80s. That's where we come into things like stagflation. That's where you have a stagnant economy that's not growing. You know, a healthy economy should be growing about 3%, sometimes 2.5%, sometimes 4%. If your economy is growing by 3% every year, you're doing good. Before then, we were growing at 5 and 6% for a lot of the period in the golden age. So all of a sudden, the economy comes to a slamming halt, but inflation doesn't stop. So the value of the dollar is dropping. Industries are starting to hurt. And this is caused because, you know, that corpse of the world, we'd picked it clean. There was no low-hanging fruit. You know, now we had rebuilt Europe. The Marshall Plan worked. You know, the Cold War was starting to come to an end. Europe made fantastic finished goods. Japan and Taiwan blew us out of the water with electronics and cars, right? China, Southeast Asia provided like so much massive and cheap labor force. It was suicide to manufacture anywhere else. In America, South America, it doesn't matter. If you can get it made in China, Taiwan, Singapore, Philippines, you can get it made for so cheap, it's still cheaper to ship it over here. And this is our problem, is we have an economy, a consumer economy, based on being the only game in town, and then suddenly we're not. So our economy comes to a screeching halt, big problem, right? And of course, there's other geopolitical issues going on, Iran's going off the rails, you know, there's a lot going on. But domestically, you know, the Kemp-Roth tax cuts come in 1981. Ronald Reagan, second worst president in U.S. history, brings in these Kemp-Roth tax cuts. There's this guy named Art Laffer, and his name is perfect because he's a debunked economist. Laffer was hailed. Everyone loved him. And it was literally this guy. I mean, Trump would kill for this kind of thing. This guy, at one point during a luncheon with a bunch of economists who actually knew what they were doing, pulled out a cocktail napkin, drove a curve on it, called it the Laffer curve and said, look, there's got to be this magic parabola where we can find this perfect range between taxation and revenue for the government. But if you go too little taxes, you don't get any money. And if you tax too high, industry shuts down, and that's our problem. If we just cut taxes way back, we'll go to that middle ground that everyone will be happy. And it catches on. Everyone's pumped about it. Reagan signs on. And that's where we get this trickle-down Reaganomics. This is where these terms come from. Because the idea was to cut taxes for heavy industries, for the ultra-wealthy. And if these guys had more money, surely they would spend it downwards. They would invest in their businesses, because that's how it had always been. You own a company, you invest in that company. You want that company to last. You want it to live longer than you. You build products and companies that will last, and that's the American capital dream we're sold. But now it's an international economy. Corporations don't need to be beholden to the country they live in anymore. They sell overseas. Trade is flying around the planet. Who cares what nation falls or doesn't? You're a large company now. You exist in the ether. So this idea of creating a lasting company, who gives a crap if the company falls? I'm going to make my money right now. And so we cut taxes to these rich people. And what happens? They take their money and run. You know, it cut the marginal income tax rate by 23% across all income brackets. And that sounds nice. That sounds like, oh, a rising tide will lift all boats, right? The problem is the people at the top are paying a bunch of taxes. And if you cut their tax rate by 23%, you are just draining money out of the federal government. It doesn't. That's the federal government's income, is taxes. And if you cut taxes, the government loses money and cannot function. And you have to do things like make major cuts to social welfare programs. We're going to gut Social Security. We're going to close mental health facilities all across the nation. We're going to do all these things to take away from the people, from the tax money they're paying to be cared for by the government. And it's going to go right into the pockets of the wealthy in this pipe dream hope that they will care for us. Young conservatives proposed this. It caught on. And it's a lie we've been told ever since. You know, this basic argument that if you free up money and slash taxes, the economy will breathe and it'll be free and everyone will make money. But all it did was consolidate capital at the top by benefiting large capital holders, right? You allow for incredible wealth hoarding. Economists at the time and today still like to point at things like unemployment rates and the stock market as measures of success, but they're not measures of a healthy society.
At all. Like, and that's one of the biggest
policies.
And people are finally, I think, starting to wake up to that, but it's 2020. People should have been well aware of this right off the bat. It's taken 40 years for people to finally catch up and be like, hey, something isn't right here. And I think that's why you're starting to see a increase in like Bernie Democrats.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. What I think a lot of people also don't realize is that our tax like rates have not been where they are today for very long. So 1945 under Truman, taxes for income were at like 95%. Then under Eisenhower all the way up until Lyndon B. Johnson, they were around 90%. So, and that's still that kind of tiered tax system where the first portion is taxed at a lower rate, and the next portion is taxed at the slightly higher rate, and on all the way up to 90%.
A progressive tax system, right?
Yeah, it's a progressive tax scheme. It's so that the smaller amount of money that you make, the less taxes you pay, and then on that larger percent of or larger number of dollars, you pay a percentage higher on just that portion, and then on up, kind of walking its way up the stairs. And then 1964 happens, and we have a drop, Lyndon B. Johnson, of about 20% tax rate. So it goes from 90 to 70%. And then under Nixon, there's a small blip up for whatever his reason is. But then under Ford and Carter, it goes back down to 70%. 70% is still pretty high. We're not anywhere near that. We're down around the 33% tax rate overall. And then once again, Reagan, 1981, 1982, 1983, our taxes drop off like Chris said, that 24%. So all of a sudden, we go from a little over 70 down to that 50% tax rate. And that's really where they started to give major tax cuts to corporations under this idea of trickle-down economics. It benefits the rich. It doesn't benefit the guys at the bottom. And that's where we're at today, because this idea of trickle-down economics persists solely because bad economists tell us it works, although every scientist worth their salt that works on that kind of stuff tells us it doesn't.
Amen.
Yeah.
And the thing is, that's a self-compounding problem, too.
It is.
Is as these the reason why we're told all these lies is because, you know, we have people like the Koch brothers, right? You know, who are absolutely influencing politics for their own financial benefit. Jeff Bezos, you know, this kind of stuff, where these guys have a vested interest in actually changing the way governing works. And that's the new phenomena, is that the wealthy, yes, there was always corruption. It never used to be from the top. And one of the things that's really cemented this, you know, kind of like when gerrymandering started, once the genie was out of the bottle, it was a runaway train. It's the same kind of thing in 2001. W. Bush did this major tax cut, right? And the thing that he cut more than anything, he cut the taxes for the wealthy. He did cut taxes for the working class as well, much less, but he did. But the big cut he did was to the estate tax. The estate tax is something we don't talk about a lot in America. We talk about income tax, we talk about sales tax, but we don't talk about estate tax. And what that is that's benefiting inheritance. It's what you pass down to your children, that kind of thing, or spouse. And what this did was it set an exemption. Right. So if your estate was worth a certain dollar amount, much like Kay was saying earlier, with the tax rate is once you make a certain amount of money, everything over that gets taxed at a higher rate. This is the same thing, is you pass down a home to your kids at a certain dollar amount, it's free. Once you get over a certain amount, you're supposed to start paying taxes. And that's to help put this wealth, this old money back into the economy. The idea of an inheritance tax is great, right? It takes that stagnant money that's not doing anything and it puts it back into the government, which can then be used on social programs, bringing up the general welfare of the populace. But by cutting it and by making sure that every year it kept jumping up, in 2020, the exemption is 11.58 million. That's what it was last year.
We're not talking about the couple of $1,000 that Granny had socked away in a savings account somewhere that she distributes between her kids and everybody gets a few $100s.
Yeah, or the $300,000 house your parents leave you.
Yeah, exactly. We're not talking about the house that it was the family house that the three kids got to liquidate and split. We're talking about when people have wealth, not just, you know, some money. They have wealth.
No, multi-millionaire.
We're talking millions and millions of dollars worth of assets.
Assets that you can split with a spouse. So if you have children you want to inherit to, when one spouse dies, what one of these cuts did is, okay, so let's say we've got 11.5 million, right? You die, you can give your kids $11.5 million of the estate, dump the rest onto your living spouse, and then when they die, the whole thing resets again. So really, it becomes $25 million between the two of you. And so that first 11, you know, if we're going by 2020 numbers, right? The first 11.58 million in your state is therefore exempt from taxation. It's only afterwards. Your state wouldn't be subject to federal tax at all if it's worth anything less than that 11.5 something, right? If you died in 2020. But then the IRS announces in October that it's going to increase to 11.7 million. So in 2019, it was 11.4. In 1 year, it jumps to 11.58. And now to 11.7. So in 2 years, right, it has jumped $300,000. And that's how it's been since 2001. It's making these insane leaps forward. While that's going on over the last 20 years, generous loopholes have been written into our tax code, in the federal tax code, And what that means is that typically if we had a wealthy inheritor, which would be, let's say, Matt, right? I'm leaving a gigantic estate to Matt. He would be subject to pay 40% of the overage, just like Kay was saying earlier with the taxes. So if I have a $20 million estate, right, and I died in 2020, that first $11.58 million is free. He then has to pay a 40% tax on the remaining 8.6 whatever million, right? It never actually happens. According to the numbers here I got from the Tax Policy Center, that the average inheritance tax paid is 17%. Not 40 to 50 to 60. Remember, with that 40% number I have, that's if you're at 11.58 million plus $1. It's supposed to go to 50, 60, 70% once you start getting into the hundreds of millions of dollar estates. It's supposed to be exponential with the wealth, but these billionaires are paying less than 17% tax.
Well, because there's loopholes written into all of these tax laws, and they can afford to pay for lawyers and accountants and everything this way, six ways from Sunday, to hide this money, park it away. It's a system that's been gamed to favor them from the beginning. And so this idea that we already have these laws in place, which is what a lot of people that are will defend this bullshit will go to, is like, well, we already have a law that they have to pay this. Well, yeah, but we also have like 18 more that shows them exactly how to get around it.
And not just that, even things that aren't tricks, like, yeah, you're right, they can pay for massive teams of lawyers to do this, but there's an inherent system in capital for this. So like a lot of the money that wealthy heirs would get from these estates, right, would never be taxed if it wasn't for the estate tax. That's actually the reason why it was created. It was in 1916. The estate tax came into being, and it was supposed to serve as a safeguard, a backstop to the income tax, right? Taxing the income of the wealthy taxpayers that would, without it, go completely untaxed. It would never be touched. And that's because of capital gains. We've all heard of this. That's cap for those who don't spend their times reading finance for whatever reason. It's riveting, right? Capital gains is basically money that you earned from not doing labor, from not doing anything. It's money that just manifested out of thin air because you're rich, so you should be richer.
Well, it's your money making money.
Yeah, exactly.
There was actually a controversy about this not too long ago. If you guys remember when Mitt Romney was running for president, this was a big thing about how much money he was like parking and not paying taxes on. And he's like, well, it's capital gains. That's what this is. It's you take a fuck ton of money, you park it in a specialized account, and all it does is sit in that account and gain interest and gain interest and gain interest.
And as long as you don't cash it out, you don't pay the taxes, which is why the wealthy put their money into assets. So like under the U.S. tax system, it's only when in the legal term is realizing, when the owner has realized the gain, which is usually only done by selling it or insuring it, right? The increase in the value is never subject to taxes until they sell it. So that's why people hold on to it. And this is why the ultra wealthy often funnel so much capital into art, real estate, jewelry, companies, because if you can keep buying shit with it, that intrinsic value stays, but you don't have to pay taxes and you end up just owning everything. Now, this is a huge departure because the working class does not do that. The working class and the poor class use most of their capital to survive. You know, what's not being paid for housing goes to food, insurance, utilities, cars, and most importantly, consumer goods. That's what we are, a consumer-based economy. That's what keeps us running. And the poorer you are, the more you actually per capita stimulate the economy. You're not hoarding and hiding wealth like an evil dragon. You're spending it. And that's the main issue. These loopholes don't just allow the unethically wealthy to continue, but game the system to increase their stranglehold on all the available capital. Amazon employees are dying without healthcare, while Jeff Bezos is just sinking his wealth into tax loopholes and rockets that we don't need. Boeing and SpaceX have this, but he's spending a fuck ton of money trying to make a rocket program because he can. He can funnel his money into it. He can feel like a big, important little boy and not pay taxes. And we measure it with, you know, how good, how wealthy. Oh, there's such unprecedented wealth. Only for a handful of people. And the fact of the matter is the economy has been dying for 50 years. And as long as we keep looking at the New York Stock Exchange, we're never going to see it.
Well, that's exactly it. Look what was happening when all this craziness was the last year, coronavirus. Like the stock has gone up, stock exchange has gone up and down, but overall it keeps getting better and better and better. Like during the DC riots, most people would think, well, the stocks had to fall. No, they rose. While all that crap was going on last week, stocks were climbing and soaring. It is the worst measure for economic stability I have ever heard of. And it's the go-to for everyone and news media too. Like they're constantly reporting it as if this is something that we should consider whenever we're looking at the economic health of this country. Meanwhile, the poor keep getting poorer. The middle class is slowly dying out. Most of them, by the way, are not getting richer and going into the wealthy class. They're going into the poor class.
Yeah.
I think there's some numbers that I saw on this was something like 70% of Americans live paycheck to paycheck.
Yeah.
That's including the ones that are supposed to be middle class and well off.
Which is why I don't care when they talk about the unemployment numbers. It's like, oh, unemployment's at such record lows. Like, well, yeah, but they're holding down 3 part-time jobs, getting no health care, and everyone's starving. That's not a high level standard of living.
And those numbers of unemployment are people that have applied for unemployment or currently on unemployment. That does not include all the people that no longer qualify for unemployment.
And the people who've given up.
Well, that's what I mean. They no longer qualify, or they're not on unemployment because they simply cannot get it.
Mm-hmm.
They've been on it for so long that they no longer qualify for benefits any longer. And so they just simply go without. They go without a job. They go without any money. They go without food. They go out and they're on the street when things get dire enough. But it's false information. And it's not necessarily false, but it doesn't tell the whole story. And the whole story is that the information is incomplete. And to base an idea of our success as a country solely on the stock market and what those rich people are doing is foolish. And the people at the bottom don't see that. They go, oh, well, the stock market's climbing, so we all must be doing better. Except unemployment rates continue to go up. People have less and less jobs. People have less and less money.
And the jobs that are exploding are the ones that are being made by the people who are doing great in the stock market, which tend to be low paying, minimum wage, no benefit, part time retail or service industry. And that doesn't build prosperity.
No, it doesn't. It never has.
How long have we been fighting for a $15 minimum wage?
It's forever.
Yeah, it's been a decade, right?
Long enough where a $15 minimum wage won't fucking matter because it will need to be $18 or it'll need to be $21.
If it's adopted nationally, $15 an hour will be the same as $7 an hour is now.
Exactly. And that's the problem, is we're not trying to build a living wage, which is, again, something a few senators, a few representatives and a few candidates have talked about, but it's never a populist message. We don't want to talk about that because we're sold this lie that you'll kill business, you'll kill industry. And it's the opposite is true. The reason why we have a handful of large conglomerates that are taking over and eating all the individuality is because there's no money left in the economy. It keeps getting hoarded by a select few. And it's not just the middle class numbers that are dropping. The ultra wealthy is dropping as well. There's less of them, more money, but they're becoming a more and more exclusive club, just like the middle class. And so
the millionaire club is shrinking.
Yeah. We're going to go back to royalty, because that's the thing, is the billionaires are the ones who are running the show. You think our senators are really running the show? It's who's their corporate donors, you know? Look at Cory Booker, okay? Cory Booker is a senator I actually have a good amount of respect for. He's crazy intelligent. He's really good at grilling bastards in Senate hearings. He really cares about the working class and the common people of his constituency. I'm a fan of Cory Booker. Bernie proposed a plan to get cheap insulin from Canada so that diabetics wouldn't die if they were broke. Cory Booker killed it. He killed the plan. And his excuse was that, well, the plan doesn't include quality testing. like Canada's making bunk insulin. It's coming from the same same pharmaceutical companies we get our insulin from. But that year, I mean, I'd have to look up the actual numbers, so don't quote me on these, but it was like $250,000 or something like that that the pharmaceutical lobbying firms dumped into his campaign. Even the best senators are subject to this system of begging for money, begging for re-election. The people with the most integrity are still held under this oppressive system of having to kiss the right cheeks to get re-elected and get anything or any bill put through Congress. And it's getting to a point where our elected officials are not running the government at all. We're getting this oligarchy that we've talked about. It's going to be monarchy soon enough, because this handful of rich are getting smaller and smaller and having more and more control over the reins of government and tax policy.
So apparently Cory Booker has received over $400,000 from the pharmaceutical industry.
Yep.
Yeah. And we're talking about Cory Booker. He's a Boy Scout, but he's one of the good guys. He actually got into it for the right reasons. Cory Booker is a Mr. Smith Goes to Washington story. The guy came from nothing, you know, cared about his people, cared about getting elevated in government, has taken, still lives in his constituent area. Like, Cory Booker's a good dude. And even he failed to this corruption where he's now taken almost $500,000 from this industry for re-election. And what did he do? He fucked over a bunch of diabetics. And it wasn't because he doesn't like diabetics. You know, Cory Booker's parents didn't get murdered in an alleyway on their way out of the opera by a diabetic by a dialysis machine. No, Cory Booker's part of the game. He's part of the system, and it sucks. But if it can do that to some of the best of us, what's it doing to everyone else? Mitch McConnell's got secret deals in Russia, and he's running coal mines. I mean, you know, the worst people are destroying the planet, and the best people are just murdering some of the elderly.
Well, and speaking of trickle-down economics, the one thing that does trickle down from all this is awful. Pure, unadulterated awful. And what I mean by that, a good example of this, is when we talk about $15 minimum wage, what is the first thing that people currently making $15 an hour will start to say? Well, I don't want a burger flipper to be making the same as me. It's this, if that person can live, it somehow invalidates the job I'm doing.
And we need burger flippers. If anything has taught us from this pandemic is that the people who are treated the worst and make the least amount of money are the most necessary in society. How many of us, especially during the initial lockdowns, no matter what state, city, country you're in, had to survive on fast food, had to go to a grocery store, or had to have something delivered by a gig worker? These people who make the least and get treated like shit are the ones who keep us alive, keep us fed. You know, you want to talk shit about custodians. Who do you think is sanitizing the hospital room you're dying in? The janitor. You need that janitor. And so if you're going to shit on him and say, well, I don't want him making the same money I'm making. Well, okay, then you do the job. But people need to unload trucks.
Yeah.
People need to build things. They need to sweep floors. They need to make food. We need everyone in this society. And to demean someone and say they don't get to have a decent living wage because I feel like looking down on their job to feel better about myself, it's inhuman.
I don't even actually think that it's always that sinister, but I think that it comes to a point where somebody says, why do they get to make as much as I make, and I work so hard for what I do? I don't know that it's always so sinister, and I'm not saying that it isn't
absolutely
sinister.
Absolutely an evil thought. Like, that is the shittiest of thoughts. I'm sorry. I'm not going to give any excuses for that thinking, because, look, bottom line is this.
I'm not giving an excuse. What I'm saying is that I don't always think it's sinister, but what I am saying is that it is a shitty thought.
Even if everyone worked, if everyone in this country tomorrow woke up and was like, you know what? I'm done fucking around. I'm going to work my ass off. I'm going to go to college. Even if all of them did that, we would still need people to deliver pizzas.
Of course we would. That's not what I'm saying.
I'm not saying that's what I'm saying. The point I'm getting at here is these jobs are necessary. And even if everyone did what people in the middle and up are saying they need to do, which is just work hard and get a degree and you'll be fine. You pull yourself up. even if everyone did that, these jobs would still be needed. So to turn around and say that that person, for whatever excuse you tell yourself, doesn't deserve to live at least a decent standard of living is, I'm sorry, it's the shittiest and most dickish move I can ever imagine.
Once again, I think that you're honestly sometimes attributing motive to someone who you don't actually know what their motivation is. You are making a statement and you're saying that anyone that thinks that they deserve to make $15 an hour or make more because someone else is going to make $15 an hour, that's not always a sinister thought. If they're going to make $15 an hour and I make $15 an hour, don't I deserve to make more?
No. I don't think you do.
Okay, but why not?
Why do you?
So the argument you seem to be making is that there are certain types of jobs that have more value than the others. And I think in certain ways, yes, I absolutely 100% think that the money, time, and hard work invested in being a doctor, for instance, is a greater investment of time, money, and energy and requires a higher skill set than flipping burgers. Do I think that means the person flipping burgers doesn't deserve to live in a nice home and have nice things?
But that's not what I said.
No, that's not what Kay said. Kay was saying simply that one can earn more. But my question is, why does anyone deserve to earn more than anyone else? And I know I'm taking this to a weird place, but follow me here. What is money? Money is the ability to pay for yourself to live. It's to get items. It's to buy food. It's to put housing. It's to buy a t-shirt. It's to get a shiny new toy you like. It's all of that. It's your tangible energy to acquire goods and services.
Agreed.
Regardless of how you contribute, why does anyone deserve a different amount of that?
I don't have a good answer for that. I wasn't trying to diminish the idea that people deserve to make enough money to live. I was simply saying that it's not so black and white of everyone that thinks, hey, if that other person is going to make $15 an hour and I make $15 an hour now, I think I deserve to make a little bit more as well.
But you're the only one making that argument.
The rising tide.
Matt and I never made that argument. Only you are.
No, but it sounded like you were making that argument.
Yeah, I that's not what I even took away from that.
Even if you weren't making that argument specifically, it sounded like it.
So let me clarify. I agree with you. I think you're right. The point where I stand is, I don't care if it's insidious or not. Whatever the motivation for a person having that thought is, it's a dick fucking thought.
Yeah.
That I deserve to make a little bit more too?
That they don't deserve it, because that's what Matt's getting at.
Not what I'm saying. It's not always an insidious thought.
Real quick, you keep going down this road that neither Matt or I are going down. You're making up this argument out of nowhere. Matt and I are talking about the people who go, why should some burger flipper get $15 an hour? It's got nothing to do with what you make.
Okay.
It has to do with trashing the people making low wages who we depend on. That's the argument he's making. Yeah. That's sinister.
That's fine. To me, it was not evident.
There are plenty of people that do what Kay is saying as well. I actually know several ambulance workers personally. They make about $15 an hour. And when the fight for 15 started here, all of them were like, I don't want a burger flipper making the same as I do. And here's the really fucked up thing about this. I don't judge any of these people to be bad people inherently. They're actually good. And they do their job because they love it and they want to help people. That's a good motivation. I respect them for that. But they have bought into this idea that A, somebody doing another job that they view as lesser deserves lesser. And B, their focus is downward when it should be upward. The question shouldn't be, why is a burger flipper making the same as me? The question should be, why the fuck am I not getting paid more like I damn well deserve to be getting paid more? And everyone, middle class down, needs to be asking this question, because while we're all blaming the person below us for making too much or saying they're making too much, the fucking CEOs have seen their salaries increase by something like 800%.
And that's kind of the point that I'm actually getting at.
And no one who's ever flipped burgers has ever made that argument, because that is backbreaking, sweating, unappreciated, long hours, blisters on your feet, exhausting, and customers spitting on you and cussing you out, and you have to take it on the chin work. It is demeaning, and it is physically exhausting. So
yes,
no,
it is.
A burger flipper deserves more money than most people, in my opinion. If you are a food service or retail worker,
absolutely,
I think you should be making more money than most people.
Actually,
teachers?
Good question, Paul. Out of three of us here, who has worked either A, retail, B, food service, or C, all of the above?
All three, comrade.
Same here.
I have not worked food service. I've worked in lots of retail. It was never one of those things that I ever got into. I was always doing other stuff.
Yeah.
But I worked in retail a lot.
Yeah.
Even as a manager of a retail location. And I'll tell you a whole fucking a lot about it someday. But I didn't make a whole lot of fucking money, I'll tell you that much.
Well, and that's part of the problem. It's because you're servicing the general public, I think that is where the perception comes in. It's like, this person serves me, therefore they are lesser, and therefore they should not make as much as I do, which is a bullshit argument, because if you think about it, at some level, and this is something that's even taught at a lot of management type levels too, everyone is in the service industry.
Yeah. Doctors are serving you.
100%. As I've mentioned before, I work in the healthcare industry. This is something that every hospital tries to adopt, is this idea of being a service employee. Everywhere, from every level, the guy that does the sterilized cleaning all the way up to the providers. They're all trained to start thinking in these terms. And again, go ahead.
If you don't think you're in the service sector, go ahead and talk a lot of shit to your boss's biggest client.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. See how well that works.
See how well that goes out for you. But so that again is what I think what we're going with is, it's not about whether or not some jobs deserve more than others, which I actually, again, I don't really agree with that. In fact, if anybody deserves a hierarchy, it should be civil servants. I have yet to ever hear a good reason why anybody deserves to make more money for doing 40 hours of labor. And again, if you want to make that argument, then it should go by how hard the labor is. Because guess what, Bill in the office? You're not working as hard as an agricultural worker, or someone flipping burgers, or someone mopping a hospital floor, or someone driving an ambulance. These are the hardest working people in the country who are paid the least. So when someone tells you they got rich through hard work, the question to ask is whose?
Well, I've got a take on this if you want to hear it.
Yeah.
So, okay. So I, surprise, surprise, I actually agree with Chris. I agree that what Chris is espousing will have to be the end goal.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we can get there overnight. And because we can't get there overnight, I think it on the road to get there, we have to accept the fact that as a society, we place a value on certain job titles.
Yes.
I think it is better to slowly change that societal perception as we're boosting up the working class. Like, you have to kind of do all of those things in tandem. I think if you just woke up tomorrow and was like, okay, doctors, you're making the same as burger flippers, as a society, they just outright reject it. Like, you have to change perceptions before you can get to that point.
I mean, throw up in the back of my throat about hearing reformism aside, that's not technically really the case historically. When tables tend to flip quickly, there's a very short period of everyone being pissed off, and then everything goes back to normal.
Okay.
When you upend economic systems, if it's for the worse, there's repercussions. But at the end of the day, everyone wants to go to work. Everyone wants to do their trade. They want to have a roof over their head and food in their belly. And whatever makes that happen is what you do. You know, again, that look at Cuba. You know, overnight they had this serfdom, slave labor, sugar plantation economy, and then a bunch of bullets went flying, and they were like, "Doesn't exist anymore. Be a doctor now," and it all worked because that's what people do. And look at the United States. I mean, the same thing. We went from this colony where we were literally a raw materials producing, you know, minion of an empire, declared independence overnight.
It was cotton and tobacco.
Yeah. And then all of a sudden, within a generation, industry rose, because that's what you do. You build society. It shifts all the time. So And again, and I agree with you, things don't happen overnight all the time. And that's not what I'm saying. But if you're aiming for a target, you talk about the target, not the journey. And true. So I absolutely tend to, especially someone philosophically, I'm a utilitarian. Mm-hmm. I care about greater good being served over how to get there as much. That's for other people with more patience than me. That's, we all have different gifts to bring to the world. But that's what I do, is I look at the target and I am always pushing for that target. The end goal is what we need. Yeah. And so that's usually what I'll focus on. But, you know, please hear me that I never expect a magic finger snap and utopia to appear overnight in New Jersey. No.
Why New Jersey?
Because it's very un-utopia.
Well, let me give you an anecdotal example, too. I remember growing up, and I'm sure everyone's had one of these conversations when you're hanging out with your family or friends or whatever, you have that discussion of what would you do if you suddenly won the lottery, right? But I think everybody's got a story about as you were growing up, you would hang out with your friends or family and talk about what would you do with if you won the lottery, right or wrong?
Buy a pharmaceutical patent and kill everyone for profit.
Cool. Yes.
So I'm right. one of the things I always remembered growing up is, and this is about when I'm about 13, 14, so, 12, 13, 14, around basically around the age of reason, I'd come to the conclusion, like, if I won the lottery, just, I don't want a mansion or a car. I just want to buy a house, like a mansion or a fancy car, I should say. I just want to buy a home that's big enough for my family, have a decent car that gets me from A to B, and have enough money that I don't have to worry about money. Like, that for me was always my own goal. And I'll never forget this, because both my mother and my biological father told me this. They said, wait till you're older and you'll understand. You'll change your mind. I am now 36 years old. I am still of that mind. I have never, never understood this idea of wanting to be a millionaire, buy a mansion, and have all these wealthy things. I've always wanted a life that is middle class, where I just had enough money that I didn't have to worry about money.
If I could. Yeah. There's a reason for that, and that's because the two generations before you sat through unprecedented economic growth and wealth increase where, yes, the dream is I was born into this level of society, and therefore that is a guarantee, that's safe, and I would like to move upwards. And flash forward to the post-apocalyptic clusterfuck that is the 21st century, and now everyone's living in their mother's basement wondering if they'll be able to pay off their student debt before they're 97 years old.
Yeah.
And it's a very different society. I think that's where that, well, when you get older, because yeah, when yeah. they got older, they had a house and a great career that only required a high school education.
And they wanted more.
Yeah. And they wanted more, which is appropriate. You know, it makes sense, but.
And most millennials or Gen Zers will probably never be able to own a home. Because they'll never make enough money, or they'll never have the desire to actually do it.
Yeah.
There's a whole group of people today that are living in tiny homes, or they're living in vans and traveling the country, and they're making remote incomes.
Yep.
I mean, personally, that's one of those things that's like super inspiring to me and has always been super like interesting. I don't think I could ever do it for some of my own like personal reasons, but it seems really cool and it seems like a really fun adventure. But that is not the norm that this country was built on. This country was built on
slavery.
Well, yes, but I'm talking about it a little bit later than that. But we were, this country was built on that American dream. Like we said, new car every couple of years. White picket fence at a house, 2.5 children, right? Yeah. That very, you know, nuclear family. Mm. And it doesn't exist anymore. More and more people are not having children, not getting married, not having traditional jobs. That is changing every day more and more.
Yeah. I mean, you're not wrong.
I would say, and this is not to, you know, I agree with you 100%. But I would say that's also a very white American experience. Not that it's negative or positive, just that that's what that is, because that American dream hasn't existed for people of color.
Agreed.
It hasn't existed for the gay community. And
no, of course it hasn't.
Hear me out. I'm not accusing you of that.
No,
what
I know.
What I'm saying
I'm
just, is,
I'm agreeing with you.
Yeah, it's something we need to keep in mind as a society, not you, but as Americans, as we talk about like, oh, this American dream. Everyone could just go to high school and have a sweet job and a golden retriever and kids and a car. And it's like, yeah, if you were a white person living in the suburbs, if you're a person of color living deep in an industrialized portion of the city, chances are you're trying not to get murdered by police or die of food poisoning and live in a crippling society that punished you economically for the color of your skin and background you came from. And that's just something that we also need to remember, is that I don't think it's that there was this massive dream for all Americans that has died. There was a massive dream for half the country that has now died. And it's interesting to note that now everyone's mad.
Well, it's like we've said in previous podcasts, it takes middle-class white people finally being affected for change to actually occur.
When the privilege, and it's any side, it's not necessarily even like, you know, in America, that's white people, but when the privileged class is upset, is when you will typically get either revolution or systematic change, depending on your country, you know, but that's when it happens.
Actually, a good example of that. We talked about Fight for 15. Does anyone remember how that really happened? I'll give you a reminder. W came and fucked up the economy. And then all of a sudden, a bunch of middle-class white people lost their fucking jobs and had to start working at McDonald's. And then within a few years, all of a sudden, the Fight for 15 happened. There's a very distinct pattern, timeline between, and it's like this weird cycle that keeps happening. Is like, I mentioned it before, like on a previous episode, but like Republicans come in and fuck this country up big time. White people get forced to realize that, hey, things aren't so good for most of it. Maybe we should change this. And then they start fighting for themselves. Which, you know, coincidentally, now that they're at the same station as people they've been shitting on their entire lives, now they all of a sudden want to change things. And that's where this stuff happens. But then the economy started getting better because we had hope and change Obama, and all these people started getting their jobs back little by little. And Fight for 15 is still there. And some, there are some places that have implemented it, I think, pretty successfully, like San Francisco hasn't, haven't they? And I think Washington State.
I don't know, but yeah, you're right. And like liberal movements tend to go, they got their token issue accomplished and then went back home.
Yeah. Yeah. This is basically, as we've been pointing out, a lot of these issues, the bulk, I think there are still major systemic issues within this country beyond just economic ones. We've talked about them on previous episodes, but all of them get exacerbated by these economic ones. Hands down, 100%. And trickle-down economics, this ridiculous policy that keeps getting shoved down everyone's throats, is the main source for a lot of that. It causes these problems. It creates this division within classes. And what's the solution, guys? What's the answer? What we're getting now from a lot of the Bernie-crats is, and from Obama, is this idea of middle out, which I like it. It's going in the right direction. But as we've advocated, I think as recently as the last episode, we're for a bottom up approach. Am I right?
Absolutely. 100%. Bottom up is the only way out of this. And we need to start spending money where it will actually do some good. And where it will do some good is in the hands of the American people. Because when you give them money, they spend money.
Yep.
When you give the wealthy money, they hide it away.
I think that is a terrific stopgap measure that will absolutely slow the pain and suffering we're going through. I do not believe it's an end goal. The end goal is to turn the pyramid upside down. I think this will alleviate suffering, but until we stop basically we need to eliminate the mass disparity between economic classes. And I don't just mean by funding the bottom. I mean things like a wealth cap. If you earn more than $1 million in profit as a human being a year, you don't need any more than that. But until there's a cap, that doesn't change. We need to make it illegal to be a billionaire.
Cool. And then, so I'm actually glad you raised that point, Chris, because a common response to a statement like that is, well, then you're removing motivation. What's the motivation? So, you being the communist, I actually want your take on this episode. Is that, what is your response to that criticism?
Since when was money the motivation for building society? Society's been motivated to be built and created long before money ever existed. Human beings like building things. We like our families. We like our friends. We like our neighbors. We like a society. What do the Amish do? They don't use money. It all goes into a pot and they buy penicillin with it sometimes, but that's about it. They raise barns. They make their cheese. You know, I mean, like every society, regardless of wealth, and that's a terrible example, but like humanity rose from caves. There was no money. It's not like the first Neanderthal looked over and was like, oh, we're screwed because those Homo sapiens have ATMs. It didn't exist. Money is new. Capitalism is incredibly new. This idea of profit-based economy for the masses is not old at all. It's a couple hundred years old at best. And that's if you really want to dig real far back, and it's kind of stretching. So no, profit motivator is a very American idea, and it's definitely how our economy is geared. So I will give them that if you take away profit, you will be removing a major motivator in America, but that's not human nature. Human nature is to put down roots, it is to be productive, and it is to contribute to your society. That exists whether or not you have profit.
Well, I agree, actually. And one of the things that I think gets missed in that argument is when people no longer have to worry about the basics, if they've got a secure place to live, financial independence, they don't have to worry about food, clothing, shelter, the basic human needs. Once those are all taken care of, it's amazing the creativity that gets spurred. Now, again, you can say what you will about us doing this. I have found that doing this, I have been the most creative that I've been in my entire life. And one of the nice things about that is I have the benefit of during this pandemic, both my wife and I have had the benefit of having jobs that have been able to work with us and be able to work from home. We haven't seen a hit to our income. We have a lot more security than we've ever had before, and it's spurring us to do things that are more creative.
Yeah, and again, that's how society forms. That's why I make that human nature argument to turn it on the head from the capitalist, because that's how you get a society, is in the beginning, everyone is doing two things, finding food, fending off tigers. That's what we do. And then eventually we start planting crops and we start learning how to gather efficiently. And all of a sudden we have a food surplus. And the second you have that food surplus, people start painting. People start making music. They start developing written language. They start staring at the stars. They start navigating. They start exploring. They start finding new ways to make cloth. They start discovering medicine. As soon as people have that free time, they immediately devote it to their gifts to contribute back to others. If money was the motivating factor for creativity, then no one would be an actor. The number one occupation for actors is bartenders and waiters. But they do it for the love of the craft. Writers write because they want to write and tell stories. Actors want to act out stories. Painters want to paint. Doctors want to heal the sick. Firefighters want to save people. These people do things because, and even the service industry, there's nothing, your job doesn't have to be flashy or noble, because in a society like I'm talking about, you still need people mopping the floors, right, of the hospital so nobody dies. But what's wrong with that? There's a nobility in that kind of labor because you're still contributing to the society. It doesn't need to be anything flashy, you know? It's contributing. You have made the world, you've done your part to keep the wheels turning on this bus that you're in. And that's what we all need to start looking at it as, instead of pointing at each other and saying, that guy just mops floors. He doesn't deserve to make a lot of money. How about we're all on the same bus? So right. I don't care who's pushing the pedals and who's fixing the tires and who's keeping the windows open. We're all on the bus. Everyone's got a job. Keep the bus rolling. That's all we need to worry about.
Well, and to close it out, I want to take a page out of here. I'm going to let our nerd flag fly a little bit here, but to take a little bit from Star Trek. Just imagine if us as a society woke up tomorrow and instead of deciding that the driving force in our lives was good, in our lives was going to be the acquisition of wealth. Imagine what would happen if, as a society, we all woke up tomorrow and decided that the driving force in our lives was the betterment of ourselves. That was it. The reason we get up and we do things is not because we want to acquire the most wealth possible. It's because we want to advance ourselves as a species, as a society, and make everything in and around us better. Imagine 100%. What we could do.
Yeah. Leonardo da Vinci died in poverty. How much money did Einstein have? Stephen Hawking had a modest house and he was head of mathematics at Cambridge. People who contribute the most aren't looking for the cash payout. In fact, money as a motivator ensures that the only people who will make giant leaps forward are the most unscrupulous and evil among us. Instead of having Einsteins, we get slavery-loving apartheid Elon Musks driving our forces. Do we really want people like Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk as our champions of innovation and creativity and of the as monuments to humanity? I don't.
Nope.
So on that depressing thought, how about a couple of white guy takeaways? Let's start again with you, the good Reverend. What did you take away from this episode?
My white guy takeaway is we as a people have a long way to go towards understanding that our wealth as a society is our people. Everyone has value, and giving a little more money to those that need it the most doesn't mean taking it away from others. And the sooner that we understand that, the sooner things will get better.
What about you, Matthew Broderick?
You know, for this one, I want to go back to that, to the hope. You know, we do kind of, we get a little bombastic here at the alt left. We get a little angry sometimes, and there's good reason for it, I think. But all three of us, at the end of the day, we believe that humans can do better, can be better. That's really what we advocate for. We want everyone to start giving a fuck about each other. And I think we can do it. Like, humans have shown over and over again that when push comes to shove, we unite. We come together. We are communal. That is the nature of our species, is to take care of one another. It is this capitalist system, this search and constant acquisition for wealth, that divides us. It is not intrinsic to who we are as humans. And I think that if we can all just, even if it's, you know, one time in a year, make the day, that day you wake up, make it be the one where you're like, you know what? Today isn't about how much money I can make. Today isn't about how much I can get for myself. Today is about what I can do for others. I think if everyone can start doing that a little bit more, we got a shot. How about you, Chrissy Poo?
You know, I'm reminded of a quote I heard attributed to Mr. Rogers, where he apparently received a letter from, you know, kids saying they were scared at an emergency when they saw it on TV. And what should they do to feel better? And he said, look for the helpers. Regardless of how bad it is, look for the helpers. There's paramedics, there's firefighters, there's people helping. And that's the spirit of what we need to do, is be those people. Be the better people in society and stop worrying about what other people have. The only time you should be looking in someone else's bowl is to make sure they have enough, not who has more or less than you. It's not a competition. We are all in the same race together. And every single person who has made a difference for the better in humanity was not in it for themselves. Carry that message forward. We need to look out for the greater good. Care about the people around you. Take care of yourself. Take care of your neighbor. Take care of your family. And stop worrying about the stock market or how Jeff Bezos is doing. These are the people we need to shun and get out of our society and change the rules. Your vote does matter, even though I don't really believe in democracy. We can still save a lot of harm this way, and we can change things for the better to start at least making it more difficult for the worst aspects of our natures to take over the society.
Amen.
On that note, thanks for joining us. For the couple of you that stayed awake through our talk about economics, I appreciate you. For those who fell asleep, I understand. We will be here every single Monday, filling your ear holes with what we think is important. Please remember to like, comment, follow, share, interact with us. We are around. We love to hear from you. We'd love to talk to each other. And until next week, remember, kids, the revolution is you.